Life is full of awesome what ifs, and some not so much, like unexpected medical costs. That's why United Healthcare provides Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans to supplement your primary plan and help manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Histories of the Unexpected, the show in which we demonstrate how everything has a history, simply everything you can possibly think of, like radiators, pride, and dandruff.
Ooh, we are beginning to put the radiators on in the Daybell household. Albeit that the gas prices are soaring through the roof. So I think we should do something on radiators, maybe on pride, or we could do shoes, snooze, booze, the blues, who's, and the brews. Oh, we should do something on bruises, I think.
Yeah, that's good.
Bruising.
Yeah.
Bruises.
And my recent suggestion today is that we would do something on, because of the popularity of the Squid Game, we're going to do something on debt, and we're also going to do something on squids, which I'm hugely looking forward to.
Squids. I love squid. Delicious to
I love squid.
Delicious
yeah,
to
I love squid. I love squid as well. It's going to allow me to talk about sea monsters and the history of sea monsters, which is one of my favourite subjects, which I talked a lot about in our episode on sharks, which you all need to go back and listen to. If you haven't heard that one, it's quite fun. You're probably
The moment, we will be following... we're so carried away with everything that we're forgetting the order of everything. However, for the moment, before we get to, you will be wondering, we will be following the links in our minds as we come across them, explaining how those histories link together in unexpected ways. Who knew, for example, Sam, who knew that the history of cowboys, inspired by the brilliant Netflix film The Harder They Fall, is in fact all about race and ethnicity? It's about black cowboys in the Wild West. It's about gunslingers, medieval chivalry and the duel, Victorian honour codes, and much, much more. Or that the history of greed, did you know, is in fact all about the seven deadly sins and Dante's Divine Comedy. It's about Francis Bacon's essay Of Riches. It's about feasting and Christmas at the court of Henry VIII. And it's also about the history of eating competitions. And also Bernard Mandeville, bees, coffee drinking, and Balzac. Who knew, Sam?
It was a tremendously good fun episode to both research and record, I can tell you that. You're probably wondering who is telling you all of this stuff. Let me tell you of my fellow presenter that if history were a forest poised to become home to more than half of the world's animal and plant species, this man would be the rain, falling from the clouds of the present, bringing that historical wilderness to life with his research and writing, falling in sheets from the sky. He is Professor Extraordinaire of Early Modern British History at Plymouth University. He is James Daybell. Hello, James.
Hello, hello. And you may well be wondering, who is that unattributed voice so ably helping Daybell co-pilot this episode? Well, let's just say that if he were a rain-related historian, you've got to be very careful in your listening here, he'd only be the exact opposite of Michael Fish, that well-known TV weatherman of the historical world. So preeminent are his skills at forecasting the future of history. Unlike Mr. Fish, who a few hours before the great storm of 1987 broke on the 15th of October 1987, said during a forecast, earlier on today, apparently a woman rang the BBC and said she'd heard that there was a hurricane on the way. Well, if you're watching, people, don't worry, there isn't. How wrong he was. This was a storm that was one of the worst storms to hit the coast. Lots of rain, of course, causing record damage and killing 19 people. You're very unlike that, Sam. You're also unlike Michael Fish because you are so elegant in your sartorial and historical attire. No kipper ties for you, methinks. Yes, you've guessed it. It's the famous historical adventurer, Dr. Sam Willis.
Hello, everyone. We are doing rain. You probably worked that out. Interesting subject, I think. And my initial thoughts, James, were just how unpleasant it is to be caught in the rain when you're not prepared for it. And I kind of actually have two responses to that. One is you either go, oh, it's all very miserable, or you just embrace it and get soaking and then plough through. What do you tend to do in the rain?
It's very similar. I used to carry an umbrella when I was younger, when I was at school, and gave it up. And now I just get absolutely soaked and just go through it. However, I have just purchased two umbrellas to help me out with the rain.
I would have paid a lot of money to see you walking around school with an umbrella. Were there many other kids with umbrellas?
It was a big trend for umbrellas, those big golfing umbrellas. Everyone wore them. However, this was in the southeast and not in the tough north or the hardy southwest. However, when I was thinking about the history of rain, I thought about it in all sorts of different ways. I thought about the work that I've been doing with my daughters in homeschooling on the history of the water cycle. So thinking about it from that perspective. I also thought about the material culture.
Do you mean the way that our understanding of the water cycle has changed over time?
Yes, I mean exactly that, Sam Willis. I mean exactly that. The science behind it, the natural world and our understanding of rain. And I'll come to that in a little bit later. But I was also thinking about the material culture of rain. So the raincoat, galoshes, wellies, the umbrella, of course, all manifestations of rain. Puddles, floods, drains, drain pipes, how one deals with rain, monsoons, for example, and sort of, you know, erratic downpours, and how that changes according to season and climate and where you are in the world. But also cultural associations with rain. The Brits are utterly obsessed with rain, constantly talking about the weather, partly because we are in such a rainy, dreary country most of the time. Also Wimbledon and rain stop play at Lord's, that kind of thing. But also thinking about rain and pollution, so acid rain, things that come down in the rain, weather forecasting and raining things, raining cats and dogs. Ooh. And I should be talking a little bit about the etymology of raining cats and dogs.
That's good. I've covered a few of those things. The acid rain I hadn't really thought about, but if I do know that if anyone wants a good example of it, all you've got to do is go and look at the west front of Exeter Cathedral, which has these most magnificent carvings, and they're made out of beer stone, which is it's a chalk limestone outcropping in the middle of the Jurassic coast, except it's actually in the middle of the Triassic coast. So that's the bit from Exmouth all the way sort of up to Lyme Regis, where the cliffs are red because they're incredibly old, 250 million years or so. But there's this bit in the middle around the village of Beer, which is lovely. You should all go and visit, where there's an outcropping of chalk limestone, and it's in the Beer Quarry caves that are lots of the really, really beautiful limestone that was used to build medieval cathedrals all over the country. So Exeter Cathedral, Norwich Cathedral, the Tower of London, Westminster Abbey is another one. It came from Beer Quarry caves, and people working, I don't know, 14 hours a day in the dark with flickering tallow candles. Anyway, to cut a long story short, the best example of it is there's a beautiful, beautiful chalky limestone on the front of Exeter Cathedral with this amazing carved screen, and you can see how they're all sort of melted a bit, or like a sad sandcastle which has become a little bit wet with a wave going past it. So the features of all of the many, many carvings are not quite there, and it's proof of just how acid rain can damage our heritage. Bit of spontaneous architecture for you there, James.
Goodness me, Sam, that's terrific. Now, where are you going to take us on your journey? Or would you like me to start?
No, it's all right. I was going to South America, basically. My initial thoughts were about discomfort in rain, and what really made me think about it was when I was rowing down the Grand Canyon. We were recreating the first ever voyage down the Grand Canyon for the BBC and Discovery. If you haven't seen that, do check out Operation Grand Canyon, which is on. You can find it on YouTube. It's fantastic. there was a moment where the boat guides suddenly went a bit quiet and looked at the sky and then started taking their clothes off. And we were like, what the hell is going on here? And the heavens absolutely opened. And there was me grovelling around trying to put on a waterproof and then becoming completely miserable and damp and wet and everything. And the guides, who obviously knew the Grand Canyon, were stripped down to pretty much nothing, got absolutely soaking. Then the sun came out and then they were dry and happy again. Meanwhile, I was sitting in wet clothes, and I suddenly learned of the local understanding of what to do with rain and how to deal with it. That made me think about the explorers of the early rainforest. So 16th century explorers in South America. Some of the best one of the best ones to think about is Francisco de Orellana. He's a fascinating guy, Spanish explorer, born around 1490. He's the first person from the Western world to navigate the entire Amazon, which is some achievement. And he joined Francisco Pizarro's army in Peru in 1533. And initially they fought against other Spaniards, Diego del Almagro, one of numerous civil wars fought between conquistadors, which is something that actually doesn't get as much interest in history as it should. I think someone should write a history about the Spanish civil wars in South America. So much of the focus is on the Spanish fighting the natives who lived there, but they spent a lot of time fighting each other. Anyway, Orellana had a wonderful time there, made good friends with Pizarro. Eventually, he gets to go on an expedition with Pizarro's half-brother, a chap called Gonzalo, and they start in Quito, up in the Andes Mountains in Ecuador. And what they do is they try and... This is on one of the many hunts for El Dorado, the City of Gold. And they can't find it, unsurprisingly. They were attacked a lot by locals. They were riddled by diseases. They were left starving. Half of the expedition was wiped out within just a few short weeks of the beginning of the expedition. But to make matters worse, what happened with Orellana and him and maybe 50 of his men become separated. So the other half go back to Quito in Ecuador, but Orellana basically has only way out is to keep going down the river. So he carries on down, travels down the river, and the group make it all the way to Venezuela, having crossed the entire continent. It is some fairly serious achievement. His diaries and descriptions have been published of what he went through, and it's fascinating to see how the Spanish kind of reacted to their new environment. Here's an extract. In this province of Quijos, which is north of Quito, many warlike Indians sallied forth against Gonzalo. But when they beheld the multitude of Spaniards and horses, they quickly retired and were seen no more. A few days afterwards, there was such an earthquake that many houses in the village where Gonzalo's party were resting were thrown down. The earth opened in many places. There was lightning and thunder, insomuch that the Spaniards were much astonished. At the same time, such torrents of rain fell that they were surprised at the difference between that land and Peru. After suffering these inconveniences for 40 or 50 days, they commenced the passage of the snowy Cordillera, where the snow fell in such quantities and it was so cold that many Indians were frozen to death because they were so lightly clad. The Spaniards, to escape from the cold and snow of that inclement region, left the swine and provisions behind them, intending to seek some Indian village. But things turned out contrary to their hopes, for having passed the Cordillera, they were much in want of provisions, as the land they came to was uninhabited. They made haste to pass through it, and arrived at a province and village called Sumaco, on the skirts of a volcano, where they obtained food. But during 2 months, it did not cease to rain for a single day, so that the Spaniards received great injury and much of their clothing became rotten. So, James, a lovely little example there of just how the conquistadors, the Spaniards, were surprised and horrified by the amount of rain. So mentions there of it raining every day for 2 months, and again before that for 50 days. And another thing I found really interesting, actually, was the use of rain. This extract's brilliant. And this is all about them catching turtles to survive. But although they cannot preserve their food for a very long time, they are not wanting in industry to procure fresh meat throughout the winter, which, though it is not so palatable as the above, is more wholesome. For this purpose, they make large enclosures surrounded by poles and completed inside so as to form lakes of little depth, which always retain the rainwater. So what they're doing here is essentially making little lagoons or little lakes by capturing the rainwater. And they use these to keep turtles in, which they capture. Having finished these lagoons, at the time when the turtles go out to lay their eggs on the beach, the Indians also leave their houses and, hiding themselves near the places most frequented by the turtles, wait until the creatures come forth and begin to occupy themselves in constructing a cave in which to deposit eggs. Then the Indians come out and station themselves at the part of the beach by which the turtles have to make their retreat to the water, and falling upon them suddenly, in a short time become masters of a great many, with no other trouble than turning them on their backs, thus rendering them unable to move. In this way, they keep them until they have pierced holes in all their shells and strung them together. Then they get to their canoes and tow the turtles without any trouble, until they have deposited them in the enclosures which they had prepared. So there they are, James. They're basically making a little kind of turtly prison, sort of a shallow lake made out of rainwater. So they're using the rainwater. That's what the natives are doing. They're using the rainwater to keep the turtles alive so they can then eat throughout the winter. So two great examples there from the diaries of Francisco de Orellana, a Spanish conquistador from the 16th century.
Sam, that was superb. And it almost sort of seamlessly rifts into something that I'm going to talk about now. I'm going to end up talking about rain dances and prayers and prayers for rain. But I'm going to start with COP26, which is all around us at the moment. Several weeks, people, the leaders of the world are all up in Glasgow. People are flying in all over the place, from all over the place. And they're talking about global warming and the climate crisis that we have on at the moment. Indeed, colleagues from my own university, the University of Plymouth, were there last week, giving demonstrations and talks, and we're very interested in a systems thinking approach to the climate crisis. In other words, what this means, and this is very good for historians, everything is joined up. So you can't just concentrate on one thing. Everything needs to be joined up. So you need to start thinking about how the government works and about legislation. You need to start thinking about people's behaviour and psychology. You need to start thinking about education. You need to have a look at big business and industry. You need to rethink how markets work. You need to rethink about how transportation works. So all of this has got me sort of thinking about rain and the absence of rain in particular, about, you know, at this very important time. So this led me to read a rather interesting book by a journalist called Cynthia Barnett, called Rain, A Natural and Cultural History. And this is absolutely fantastic. And it really is a cultural history of the world's relationship with rain. And it starts by thinking about the climate crisis that we have. And this is the idea that the US Senate in 2014 rejects the scientific consensus that humans are causing global warming. And in the book, the author, Cynthia Barnett, you know, describes this, and I'll just read this. Those who dismiss science in the 21st century are in danger of repeating the mistakes of the Brits who called ship forecasting black magic in a time when shipwrecks took the lives of thousands of sailors. Yeah, so this is one for you there, Sam. So this is, you know, we defy this kind of scientific knowledge at our peril. And this then leads her to go on and think about the kinds of relationships that people had with rain. And she starts by, the book spans 4 billion years. So she's talking about, you know, the way in which the oceans were made. She also talks about the sort of creation of the Earth. And the Earth was not the only planet with water on it in our solar system. If you think about Mars and Venus, they both had water too, but the oceans vaporized into space. While what's distinct about the Earth is that it keeps its life-giving water. And so this is what allows for humanity to survive, human life and animal life to and plant life to survive. The book also treats the relationship that different cultures, different times and different places have had with rain. So if you think about ancient Rome, they have its rain god and Jupiter Pluvius. The Aztecs sacrificed their young children to a rain god, Tlaloc. And if you think about the way throughout history, rain has been seen as something that is important, and particularly storms and particularly portents of doom and those kinds of things. It's played a really important part. Take, for example, King James VI of Scotland in 1589. And this is all sort of wrapped up with his belief in witchcraft. He believed that that storms were summoned by witches that prevented his bride, Anna of Denmark, from arriving on Scottish shores to marry him. So there's always been this sort of sense that bad weather and rain has led to superstition. And we can see this in more modern times, certainly in America. Think of Thomas Jefferson, for example, a very famous individual, to say the least. This was a man who built his home in Monticello. We've talked about him in the past. And he is somebody who was obsessed with measuring rain as a way of thinking about this superstitiously, and wanting and wishing for rain. In the 1890s, we see something being passed in the US Congress that persuades people to invest in rainmaking experiments. And basically what you have is a guy called Charles Benjamin Farwell, who's a senator from Illinois and who owned, massive territories in Texas. He pushes through a bill to fund rain concussion trials, which is basically where scientists who have been discredited bomb the skies to try and make it rain. And this actually is something that people have believed in for quite some time. But as I said, the science behind it was discredited. So there is this sort of sense in which people are trying to make it rain because rain is so important for crops and for civilization. If we move from those kind of literate sources and that sort of Western cultures to indigenous cultures, we can see how rainmaking is a very important part of various cultures around the world. And one of the most famous is North American, Native Americans, and particularly the rain dances that were performed in southern Western United States. And a really brilliant depiction of this is in a painting, which I sent you through courtesy of email, Sam, by a famous American artist, adventurer, George Catlin, who specialised in painting Native Americans of the Old West. And it is a painting called Rainmaking Among the Mandan. And it's dated 1837 to 1839. It's in the Smithsonian American Art Museum, and it's a beautiful oil on canvas. And what you have is you've got these sort of oval, what look like teepees, but they're not the sort of travelling teepees. They're much more domed than that. And on the top of it, well, you've got the sort of tribe members around, and on the top of it, one of these dwellings stands a young Native American brave holding what looks like a bow with feathers on it, and he seems to be performing a rain dance. And this was something that Catlin was really, really interested in particular, the role of individuals, medicine men, to perform these dances, to volunteer, to stand on their lodges all day, basically to command the rain to come down on them. But it's not just Native American societies where people try to call on the rain to rain, as it were, rainmaking rituals. But it's also in African societies, and we can also see it in... we can also see it in Muslim societies where there is a rain prayer. And the relevance here is that in Islamic prophetic tradition, there's an example in the Quran where Muhammad was delivering a sermon in the mosque and was visited by somebody who implored him to pray for rain to fall because the men and the cattle around suffered from a lack of water. And Muhammad, in response, makes this prayer to God, and lo and behold, it rains, and then Muhammad then prays to God in order to stop this torrential rain. And from this ritual has gone into Islamic tradition. So there we are, Sam. There is a couple of examples of how we go from COP26 through an understanding of rain and our relationship to rain through various traditions for rainmaking.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. If you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Use the Stamps.com mobile app to mail everything you need to keep your business running with up to 89% off USPS and UPS. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Use code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.
Rituals.
Amazing. I did really like that picture of the Mandan picture. Amazing. I love his feathers. This chap standing on top of his hut, calling up to the sky, just stretching back. He's got a very interesting bow. It looks like a recurved bow. Which obviously has its own history. Anyway, with everyone sitting around, all with feathers in their hair, also looking up and staring up at the sky. I think that's a really wonderful picture. I wanted to talk a little about Alexander von Humboldt. Having spoken about the Spanish conquistadors, I think that the whole history of South America, there's so much focus on the Spanish, the conquistadors and the violence and the terrible cultural disasters that happened there because of the Spanish conquistadors and wiping out the native populations by introducing diseases, and also with their violence, their search for wealth and for gold. There are so many terrible aspects to that story. I think that it's a shame that they get so much attention. And one really good corrective for that is to look at the history of Alexander von Humboldt, who's a really wonderful person, fascinating individual. 18th and 19th century Prussian. He's a geographer, naturalist and an explorer. And he travelled extensively through Latin and South America with Aime-Jacques Bonpland. And they collected a huge variety of flora and fauna, made significant discoveries. It's an amazing sentence, but then completing the extensive mapping of South America. Really, really extraordinary achievement. And his writings nowadays are gaining a lot of interest and a lot of focus because he was, among more than anything else, a real citizen of the world is probably the way to describe him. He feels quite contemporary in his awareness of the natural world around him, his interest in science as well. And I think he is going to become a profoundly influential guiding force for the present day. James, you're talking about what's going on with COP up in Glasgow. And it's figures like von Humboldt, I think, who are really going to A light's going to shine on them, I think, over the next few years as people look back in the past to see who lived and was really immersed in their world and in the environment around them. One of the greatest examples of von Humboldt is in Venezuela. He sees the effects of monoculture, deforestation. He talks about harmful human-induced climate change at a very early time. And he was super famous in the English-speaking world. It's quite funny now, sort of saying, you need to think about von Humboldt. Everyone needs to know about him. But it was the fact that he was forgotten is actually all to do with the First World War, lots of anti-German sentiment, and a lot of famous German figures in the past were not just ignored, they were condemned to a banished past. In Cleveland, one great example, they celebrated Humboldt's centennial in 1859, but at the outbreak of the First World War, they burnt all the German books in their library. It's really interesting thinking about how and why we might have forgotten about someone so important. I particularly love his account paddling down the Orinoco and the surrounding river networks. And he's paddling for 1,400 miles for 75 days deep in the rainforest, where few Europeans had ever been before. It's an extraordinary story. There are plenty of terrifying encounters with jaguars and crocodiles. And he later travels through the Andes, the harshest landscape you can imagine. And that's the link with Francisco de Orellana, who I read out a little bit before. So in comparison, here we've got 18th, 19th centuries. So hundreds and hundreds of years after the Spanish conquistadors. And you've got von Humboldt exploring. Opposite the cavern of Bermudez, two spacious caverns open into the crevice of Cuchivano, from which at times flames rush out that may be seen at a great distance in the night. The adjacent mountains are illuminated by them, and judging by the elevation of the rocks above which these fiery exhalations ascend, we should be led to think that they rise several hundred feet. This phenomenon was accompanied by a subterraneous, dull and long-continued noise at the time of the last great earthquake of Cumana. It is observed chiefly during the rainy season, and the owners of the farms opposite the mountain of Cuchivano assert that the flames are become more frequent since December 1797. In vain we attempted in an herbalization we made at Rinconada to penetrate into the crevice, wishing to examine the rocks that had seemed to contain in their bosom the cause of these extraordinary conflagrations. The strength of vegetation, the interweaving of the lianas and thorny plants, hindered our progress. Happily, the inhabitants of the valley themselves felt a warm interest in our researches, less from the fear of a volcanic explosion than because their imagination was struck with the idea that the Risco del Cuchivano contained a gold mine. And although we expressed our doubts of the existence of gold in the secondary limestone, they wanted to know what the German miner thought of the richness of the vein. This goes on and on, but it's his description of exploring this fascinating mine during the rainy season and how they coped with it and all of the observations they thought about the rain in particular, the mud, and how people coped with it at the time. And the way he immersed himself in the environment, James, I think is fascinating and an important lesson to us all.
Superb stuff, Sam. From there, I'm going to take us to Raining Cats and Dogs via a wonderful poem by Jonathan Swift, that 18th century Anglo-Irish poet, essayist, political pamphleteer, famous for Modest Proposal, Gulliver's Travels, Tale of a Tub, all of those kinds of things. And the title of this poem is a description of a city shower. Careful observations may foretell the hour, by sure prognostics when to dread a shower. While rain depends, the pensive cat gives o'er her frolics and pursues her tail no more. Returning home at night, you'll find the sink. Strike your offended sense with double stink. If you be wise, then go no far to dine. You'll spend in coach hire more than save in wine. A coming shower your shooting corns presage. Old aches throb. Your hollow tooth will rage. Sauntering in coffee house is dullman seen. He damns the climate and complains of spleen. Meanwhile, the south, rising with dabbled wings, a sable cloud athwart the welkin flings, that swilled more liquor than it could contain, and like a drunkard gives it up again. Brisk Susan whips her linen from the rope, while the first drizzling shower is borne aslope. Such is that sprinkling which some careless queen flirts on you from her mop, but not so clean. You fly, invoke the gods, then turning stop to rail. She singing still whirls on her mop. Not yet the dust had shunned the unequal strife, but aided by the wind fought still for life, and wafted with its foe by violent gust. 'Twas doubtful which was rain and which was dust. Ah, where must needy poet seek for aid when dust and rain at once his coat invade? Sole coat where dust cemented by the rain erects the nap and leaves a mingled stain. Now in contiguous drops the flood comes down, threatening with deluge this devoted town. To shops in crowds the daggled females fly, pretend to cheapen goods but nothing buy. The Templar spruce, while every sprout's a brooch, stays still, 'tis fair, yet seems to call a coach. The tucked-up seamstress walks with hasty strides, while seams run down her oiled umbrella's sides. Here various kinds, by various fortunes led, commence acquaintance underneath a shed. Triumphant Tories and desponding Whigs forget their feuds and join to save their wigs. Boxed in a chair, the beau impatient sits, while spouts run clattering o'er the roof by fits. And ever and anon, with frightful din, the leather sounds, he trembles from within. So when Troy chairman bore the wooden steed, pregnant with Greeks, impatient to feed, those bully Greeks, who, as the moderns do, instead of paying chairman, run them through, Lacoon struck the outside with his spear, and each imprisoned hero quaked for fear. Now from all parts the swelling kennels flow, and bear their trophies with them as they go. Filth of all hues and odours seem to tell what street they sailed from by their sight and smell. They, as each torrent drives in rapid force, from Smithfield or St. Pulchre's shape their course, and in huge confluence joined at Snow Hill Ridge, fall from the conduit prone to Holborn Bridge, sweeping from butcher's stalls dung, guts and blood, drowned puppies, stinking sprats, all drenched in mud. Dead cats and turnip tops come tumbling down the flood. So there we are, Sam. There is an 18th century depiction of a shower, an immense shower of rain on a city, and how all the people, you know, expect it, and then how they deal with it, how they hide from the rain, and how you stay at home, all those sort of things. There's a real sort of, you know, everyday life sort of depiction of an 18th century city stung by rain. But what I'm interested in is these phrases about raining cats and dogs that we have here. And the sense there is that it's raining so hard that actually it's drowning puppies and dogs. I don't think that this is where the saying raining cats and dogs comes from. And it got me thinking. I was reading a brilliant book, Word Origins and How We Know Them, Etymology for Everyone, by Anatoly Lieberman. And this is a wonderful book. I recommend that you should all have a look at it. He deals there with how, with etymology and how words come into being and how phrases change their meaning over time. And with this phrase, it's raining cats and dogs, he starts by thinking about how phrases like this come into being. It may be that they are, you know, that it's a foreign phrase that is very common. It's repeated all the time. It's translated verbatim, so it's translated literally, which basically turns it into gibberish. So that's one possibility with this. Second is that meanings may have changed themselves over time. In other words, raining cats and dogs raining, or raining cats and dogs maybe meant something related to superstition or practices in the past, which we now don't know. So it's a forgotten fact, superstition or custom. Now, I want to go on from here to think about some of the sort of different theories that he puts for the derivation of raining cats and dogs. There's one case that says it's all about Nordic. So the source for raining cats and dogs is Nordic. Allegedly, in Norse mythology, cats were supposed to have great influence on the weather, he writes. Dogs were a signal of wind, and cats were a symbol of heavy rain. But he argues that this can be connected to Odin, the storm god, who's represented by, you know, blasts of wind. The dog is attendant upon him, but basically argues that this isn't, you know, this isn't the case, that Odin is basically followed by flying corpses rather than cats and dogs. So the idea that this English idiom is traced to Scandinavian roots and Scandinavian oral tradition isn't one that he agrees with. The other possibility is in fact that it is a corruption in the 19th century of a foreign Greek phrase, the phrase katadoxa, which means contrary to expectation. So it's raining cats and dogs contrary to expectation. The problem with this is that it actually doesn't, we actually don't know how that would translate into English or how that would come about in practice. So, for example, how did that phrase make its way into English? Was it something that was fashionable in the universities, university wits? Did it have popular origins? There is really no evidence of this at all. And so, you know, the idea that it is Greek derivation, I think, also needs to be sort of got away from. The other version is put forward, comes from a source in 1919. It was someone wrote, and I quote, "I think I have heard somewhere that this phrase is a corruption of tempo cattivo, bad weather, and that it was introduced into England by Nelson's sailors who had served in Italian waters. This came a few years before the completion of the OED." But again, this idea about it being bad weather, again, there's no solid evidence for this. It's something that it really makes no sense at all. The most ridiculous one, however, version comes from the Netherlands and a scholar called John Bellenden Kerr, who wrote, and I quote here, "It rains cats and dogs. That is, the rain is violent and drives to the face. It rains cats and dogs. This is a proper current in the eyes. It is a thorough drive upon the eyes. It is as if its only object was our eyes. How properly it can beset one's eyes. The phrase is evidently jocular in both travesty and original, and evidently spoken by one who had been peppered by some driving storm of rain. Et het this it rain, pure, unmixed, proper, sheer. Es is. Ketzer is the participle present of kitzen, to chase, to drive, on or after, to pursue, to hunt, do, ogs, diogs, the eyes." This is absolutely utter drivel. The most likely, however, is referred to in a Notes and Queries article, 12th series, volume 4, 1918, in a piece written by Enny Toke. And he looks at a 1592 sentence in the Oxford English Dictionary, category 17 it is. And the phrase is from Gabriel Harvey. "Instead of thunderbolt shooteth nothing but dog bolts or cat bolts." And what the argument that he puts forward is that by the end of the 16th century, the phrase cats and dogs must have been known. And that he quotes, dog bolts and cat bolts are terms still employed in provincial dialect to denote respectively the iron bolts for securing a door or gate and the bolts for fastening together pieces of timber. In other words, what it's saying is that it is raining so heavily that it is like really heavy pieces of door furniture showering down on you. And this also relates to a further extension of this phrase, which is that it is raining cat bolts, dog bolts and pitchforks. Moving on from there, there are also a whole range of bizarre expressions in different languages for heavy rain. In Afrikaans, it is raining old women with clubs. In Albania, rain is falling like ropes. Another one is God is taking a piss or God is crying. In Cantonese, it's raining dog's poo. Or in Chinese, it's raining out of basins. I'll look for some of my favourites here. In Danish, it is shoemaker's apprentices. It's raining shoemaker's apprentices. In Dutch, it's raining old women. Or it's raining pipe stems or stair rods. It's also raining kittens. In Finnish, it's raining as if poured from a bucket. In French, it's raining like a peeing cow. That's one of my favourites there. In Hindi, raining like a pestle onto a mortar. In Icelandic, like poured from a bucket. Japanese, earth and sand distending. Italian, poured from a basin. Latvian, it's raining like from buckets. What other words? In Portuguese, it's raining snakes and lizards. In Punjabi, rain that beats kids. In Romanian, it's raining frogs. Where else? In Spanish, it not only is it raining a lot, but it's also cold and windy that being hit by the drops hurts. In Spanish, toads and snakes. Another one in Argentina, pieces of dung head first. In Colombia, it's raining husbands. Another one in Swedish, it's raining small nails. The rain stands like canes hitting the ground. And in Ukrainian, it's pouring like from a bucket. And in Welsh, old ladies and sticks. So there we are, Sam.
I love it.
From Jonathan Swift to Raining Cats and Dogs.
It makes me... we did our podcast, I think my favourite ever episode on the history of nonsense, and it did remind me of that. I think we should go back and or do gibberish, maybe. Because
yes, definitely.
That's another good one. Well done, everyone. Thank you for listening. I would just add that if you are interested in rain and the First World War, you could do no worse than studying the history of the Passchendaele Offensive, which is there's something, there's a military campaign which was ruined by rain for you. So do make sure you investigate that. I hope you've enjoyed it.
I had a whole piece prepared on Singing in the Rain, Sam. I don't have time to go into it now, but I was really interested in how they actually got that rain scene to work. And apparently what they did was they blacked out, you know, two whole streets in Hollywood to film this. And it was a time of a drought. And and Gene Kelly had a roaring temperature, was really ill. And they made him rehearse this or perform it for about 2 to 3 days. He was really ill with it. And they were worried that the rain wouldn't show up when they actually filmed it. And there was a theory that actually what they did was they put milk in the it mixed in with the water to make it show up on camera, but that's actually an urban myth, and in fact it was the backlighting that allowed it to be seen. So there we are, Singing in the Rain, one of my favourite movies of all time.
I love that. Guys, if you want more of our gibberish and nonsense and thoughts, do please check out us online. You can follow me on Twitter at Dr. Sam Willis. And if you're interested in the history of the sea, maritime history, please check out my other podcast, the Mariner's Mirror podcast.
And you can follow me on social media on Twitter at James Daybell. You can follow the podcast at Unexpected Pod. We are also on Instagram and Facebook, so like us there. If you want to become a patron, head over to Patreon. And we have a Histories of the Unexpected Patreon account. And anything you can do to help us change the way in which you think about the past would be most appreciated. And finally, you can check out everything that we're doing on our website, historiesoftheunexpected.com, including signed books just in time for Christmas.
Wonderful Christmas present. That's it, guys. We're going to be back with debt and squids, which is going to be really good. See you soon. Bye-bye.
Take care, guys, and stay dry.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you, with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.